Ernst Friedrich, pacifist reaction to the war, put together this collection of these images. And as you can see, a number of those cases contrasted the official version, the version that the home front had been aware of, and that continued to fuel the cleansed version of the war, as is true of almost every war culture then and since, with these images of, you know, of the realities of what had taken place at the front and what really happened when a shell hit a body. The neat, clean trenches, as opposed to those trenches the way they really were, muddy, filthy, filled with vermin, filled with bodies. The comrades, you know, drinking around the table, as opposed to, and so forth. And, I mean, the further you go into, you know, really the more catastrophic it gets. Mass burials here, implying probably torture of prisoners or not taking prisoners. The truths of war. Band of Brothers does a pretty good job of telling us, yeah, even American soldiers didn't take prisoners under certain circumstances. That was kind of a minor controversial aspect of that show, that it showed that that sort of thing took place. The atrocities against civilians, right? Our soldiers wouldn't do that. Well, guess what? You know, there are the photographs of it. And, you know, ultimately, and there's a point where, you know, you may not want to go beyond where the impact of these shells on bodies and faces and so forth in photographs from the military hospitals show up. And these, you know, reconstructed faces or the use of, you know, very early efforts to reconstruct damaged faces. But as I say in one of these lectures, prosthetics were not what they are now. So you are talking about, especially in the post-war period, seeing people all over, 21 million wounded, right, all over Europe with these sorts of disfigurations, to say the least. And so Otto Dix's images of them, right, although cartoonesque, are designed to force you to confront this directly. Right. And it wasn't in the common discourse. It wasn't in the common culture. It wasn't in the popular culture. And Friedrich is putting this out there because it's not. And Otto Dix is doing those drawings and doing those paintings to tell you that. And Remarque is writing his book to do the same. So let me continue with my monologue here. I'm going to try to go as quickly as I can so that we do have time to come back to your forum discussions. But I wanted to open by showing you those images that wouldn't open last time, and also because the passage that we finished with did deal with the shell shock. I'm not so interested in the production of that particular documentary or whatever, but those films do record the extremes to which that condition went. And you know, maybe those films were extreme cases. Of course, people argued at the time that these guys might be feigning it, they might be faking it, right? And the point isn't even to prove that that's true, but that shell shock is such an image of the war. And you know, maybe the first stage towards starting to deal with this issue of post-traumatic stress syndrome and so on. I mean, and indeed, although not part of our course, an important step in the sort of confirmation of Freudian notions, at least the notion that the talking cure and bringing things out of this and getting them out in the surface and so on is important, because they did, orderlies and doctors did start to use techniques like that to try to get at the neurosis that supposedly was a feminine problem, but that had been triggered in the case of these men in battle. So if they could just say what had happened, as I said last time, seems to have derived some relief. So it's all—it's part of the history of that, of those ideas as well. Yeah. You mean the shaking and the yeah? You sort of have to judge that yourself as to whatever the quality of that was. But I've seen those clips in the better PBS / BBC productions, and that's pretty much what they, these people are really. I won't do it, but I did. But I mean, I won't do it again. and worse than what you see there. I mean, the ones they don't show are the ones who are just frozen, cruciform, fetal position, which were conditions that that the early psychiatrists and psychologists were trying to deal with at the end of the 19th century, mostly in the case of women. So now they're seeing it in the case of men, right? And that then that contributes to the advance of the study that way, right? It's no longer a woman's disease; it's a soldier's disease, right? But then that whole legal issue that these guys are confronting, which is whether to go back or not. And I should be careful with time, but the two most famous British World War I poets. Okay, now there are these incredible poems, and I'll put Wilfred Owen's Dulce Decorum Est up for you, which is the most famous one, describing ultimately what it's like to see one of his comrades who wasn't able to get his mask on in time for a gas attack and watching him literally cough his lungs up in front of him through the green fog, looking through the goggles of his gas mask and seeing this happen, and ultimately condemning the pre-war romantic notion that had been drilled into the minds of every young boy that it was dulce et decorum to die for your country, that it was beautiful and fitting to die for your country. And he says that is the old lie in the face of all of this. Right, so one of the most famous articulations of that. And the other great British First World War poet, both of whose work have been now incorporated into the great canon and are in collections right next to Shakespeare and right next to Keats and right next to Shelley and whoever you want to list, they are now, they have, a generation or, a couple of generations later, been acknowledged as supreme, as Siegfried Sassoon. Right, and they actually met in hospital, facing this decision as to whether or not to have themselves declared insane, or tried for cowardice, or go back. And one of the great tragedies in literary history is that Wilfred Owen decides to go back, and actually, I think he actually escapes from the hospital and sneaks back to get to his unit. So here's that camaraderie and that bonding. He just couldn't stand to be away from them, surrounded by all this hypocrisy of the home front, right? And he gets back just in time to be killed in the last week or even the last couple of days of the war, right? So Wilfred Owen is a real symbol of all of these things, having suffered from shell shock, having written this poem, and then ultimately dying, because he just can't stay away, right? He can't stay away. So, the German versions, and there are many, include Ernst Jünger, and include Walter Flex, and include Erich Remarque, on all sides. These men are all victims of the situation, how they respond to it, whether it's emphasizing something that they could derive from it and that society could derive from it, or condemning it as a nihilistic end. They're all victims of the situation, and important sources. So I'm just going to pick up with 109 and then we'll discuss more and try to get through as much as this can and open discussion in a few minutes. But on 109 we have this description of shell shock, and you see those images, and here we have Remarque's effort, not you having that film to show people, that though he raves and an eyes roll, it can't be helped. We have to give him a hiding to bring him to his senses. We do it quickly and mercilessly. And last, he sits down quietly. The others have turned pale. let's hope it deters them. This bombardment is too much for the poor devils. And if I recall correctly, ultimately this, you know, this kid jumps up and runs out, can't stand it anymore, and runs out and is killed in the bombardment. Right? If I remember the story correctly. Right? Then on pages 112 and 113, we have his language that gave rise to the imagery that you saw in the film last time. How do you use language to describe those assaults, right? Very difficult, right? But we do have to remember, somebody sat down and wrote those stories that ultimately the latest film techniques can use to create The Hobbit and to create Lord of the Rings. Somebody sat down and wrote those stories, J.K. Rowling, that became the sense that, you know, don't forget that the words came first. In this case, the words came first. This is a remark telling you what it was like when the barrage now falls behind us and the attack has come and the stormtroopers are coming and artillery opens fire and machine guns rattle and rifles crack and the charge works its way across. Right, and they've suffered heavily when they reach the remnants of the barbed wire entanglement. A whole line has gone down before our machine guns. Right, then we have some stoppages, and then they come nearer, and so forth, and moving ahead. For one mad moment, the whole slaughter whirls around like a circus around me. Right? We become wild beasts. We do not fight. We defend ourselves against annihilation. It is not against men that we fling our bombs. What do we know of the men at this moment when death is hunting us down? Right? So it's just this sort of sublime moment of total immersion. They're not thinking about anything. They're just caught up in it. And by the way, that's the kind of thing that Ernst Jünger said was somehow beautiful. Those moments when he's outside of himself. Right, which is part of that whole romantic idea that you escape that immediacy and you're outside of yourself, you're bigger than yourself. And he, rather than in horrible terms, he writes about that in literally the language of romantic sublimity. I'm like a creator in this. I'm a destroyer creator. I become something bigger than myself as I stand up over the top and survey this, and then submerge my identity and my personality into this destructive process, right? So that's Ernst Jünger's version of it, same moment, right? But that total involvement. On 114, the blast of the hand grenades impinges it powerfully on our arms and legs. Crouching like cats, we run on, overwhelmed by this wave that bears us along, that fills us with ferocity, turns us into thugs. All right, so not into creators, not into divine, you know, forces like Jünger. Now, you know, you have remarks saying, no, it turns us into thugs, into murderers, into God only knows what devils. All right, so that's the opposite of that right wing version of it. Right? This wave that multiplies our strength with fear and madness and greed of life, seeking and fighting for nothing but our deliverance. If your own father came over with them, you would not hesitate to fling a bomb at him. Right? So there's the dark side of it. Right? And also the dehumanization, the brutalization of these soldiers, but the brutalization of culture and society as a whole. You know, seeing things like a man on the next page has had his head blown off. He runs a few steps more while the blood spouts from his neck like a fountain. Right? Now, popular culture didn't catch up with this until the first 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan. Right? We did not see the blood spurting in any movie, even Deer Hunter, well, a little bit in Deer Hunter when they do but really, you know, films until Apocalypse Now, Deer Hunter, and then finally Saving Private Ryan really puts it in those terms that you're used to seeing, I guess. For me, though, you know, war was still clean. We ran around and played John Wayne and Sands of Iwo Jima, and we shot down Germans, and nobody bled or anything, and no blood spurted out. We acted like it did, but it didn't. Right? It was clean. Right? Now, so we're back here 50 years before even that. So it was really clean for these kids, and remarks trying to do, let's say, a Saving Private Ryan in this book, right? Page 116, again, this dehumanization, this brutalization. And this is going to play itself out. I'm planting seeds that are going to play itself out in our discussion of Weimar and Weimar politics, because the feeling is that you have a generation mainly lost, but those who survive are tough and toughened, or youth trying to live up to that. And so, at least in the streets of Germany, the political world gets tough, gets brutal. You fight your opponents. You talk about annihilating your opponents. You undertake to destroy your opponents, right? Not just coming from the far right, but it's part of the whole discourse of the post-war era, right? So here's, you know, the basis of this is not just to hold your nose in the trenches, but to establish the impact that this has had. Remember, this being written in 29, not 19. This is 29. We have lost all feeling for one another. We can hardly control ourselves when our glance lights on the form of some other man. We are insensible dead men who through some trick, some dreadful magic, are still able to run and yell. Right? So no human connection anymore in this now mechanized, somebody reiterated that notion of the drones today, process of killing. Right? We are burnt up by the hard facts. Like tradesmen, page 122, we understand distinctions like butchers, necessities. We are no longer untroubled. We are indifferent. We might exist there, but should we really live where? Live there. We are forlorn like children and experienced like old men. We are crude and sorrowful and superficial. I believe we are lost. Now, you guys started a thread on lost generation. We'll try to come back and talk about that. But the American literary version of it, applies to with cause. You know, this Hemingway Dos Passos, Tenderness of Night, F. Scott Fitzgerald, pessimism. Right. Remember, Gatsby is not. That's not a happy novel. That's a sad novel, right? He's a veteran, right? With his dark view. Right? And then Hemingway, oh, yeah, he's a bombastic, misogynist, drinking male chauvinist pig. There's no doubt about that. But you know, he's always working on the experience of the war, right? I mean, that's underneath the surface of all of that. Which would also be true of so many men, including my grandfather, who I mentioned last time, you know, was working that out, and alcohol and masculinity, right, are the refuges of that generation. But here we have, as the discourse pointed out, I'm sort of answering those questions as we move along, the numbers, right, the sheer proportions of it, and the fact that physically, you do have a lost generation. And sure, I mean, it wasn't absolute. It wasn't down to zero. But the groups that were really decimated were the upper middle classes and these elites, private school, public school, gymnasium soldiers who went in as junior officers. You know, junior officers are always the first ones to go. You want to pick off the officers, and that leaves the squad without leadership. So lieutenants are getting wiped out. But also they did. They're the ones who constructed all of these notions of war enthusiasm and volunteerism and so on and so forth. The farm boys and the laborers and the workers, I mean, they just go because they're forced to go for the most part. I mean, that's the truth of it, despite this myth of volunteerism, right? And as George Mossy says, one of the great scholars of all of this. I mean, the lower classes experience things like they experience bad weather or a storm. You know, it's not as conscious. But those those elite kids went in, and those who did died in great numbers. So you lose the literate generation. They're decimated. Right? They're decimated. Uh, 126. Just a reminder, because it shows up in so much of the discussion of shell shock, and it's just something that in the films and in the movies and in the other documents you can't get, but it's one that you've just also got to project onto your efforts to empathize with the battleground situation, and that is how incomprehensibly smelly the trench areas were. You know, they say that when you drove toward them, you could smell it for 20 or 25 miles. Right? Because remember, you're talking about 4 years of bodies in this strip of, let's say, 5 miles that reaches from the English Channel down to the Alps. Right, of just grinding battle and horses and men dying and not being buried and just being ground up by the assault and so on. So it's just mud and literally guts rotting for 4 years in the heat and in the winter and so on and so forth. And Remarque captures some of that. The shells have buried them. Many of their bellies swollen up like balloons. They hiss, belch, and make movements. The gases in them make noises. When the wind blows toward us, it brings us the smell of death, which is very heavy and sweet. This deathly exhalation from the shell hole seems to be a mixture of chloroform and putrefaction and fills us with nausea and retching. I guess there I'm just sort of holding you down to recognize it, but it's part of the literature and the memoir, like the horses. These are the things that sort of push people over the top. I think, you know, you may not even think of it as significant are the ones that sort of would trigger the shell shock. Right? And then a lot of them couldn't eat, right? They couldn't eat anymore. And it's that sort of the smell of food or anything organic, right, would trigger that incapacity. Okay, I tell myself to go to page 134 now. Okay, bottom of page 134. Another horrible description. I'm going to spare you, right? Man running, clasping his intestines, okay? Right. The horror, the brutality, the impact of the shelling on the human body. You read it. I won't read it out loud for you right now. Right. Still, the little piece of convulsed earth in which we lie is held. We have yielded no more than a few hundred yards of it as a prize to the enemy. But on every yard, there lies a dead man. Right? So the futility of it, right? He captures that through that whole process. And then on page 136, he tells you that his group were 150 strong when they entered, and now in autumn, they're down to 32, right? 32 men, right? 120. And those kinds of casualty rates were pretty standard through the 4 years. So for someone like Ernst Junger to make it all 4 years at almost every offensive as a stormtrooper is, you know, it's beyond belief. So his story is quite remarkable in that sense. Okay. Now, starting on page 154, and I'm mostly going to talk over the top of it, Paul and Joyce leave. But as you know, it's devastating, right? His return home, right? And here we have this remarkable depiction of that disconnect between the front and those who didn't experience that. It's the basis for the more positive notion that we've gone through something and we should come back and be the aristocrats of the next era, those of us who've survived it, or at least conscious of it. But on the other hand, it's also the basis for, a tremendous amount of disaffection and pessimism about society as a whole and Western culture and leadership. And, you really get the beginnings of a 20th century the beginnings of this of a 20th century loss of confidence in those fundamental pillars of what was the pre-World War world. Okay? And I wonder if I can find it really quickly. One of the most amazing, two quotes here. Let's just see if I can find it. Tender as the Night. Passage, war. Let's see if that comes out. I should have it for you. If I won't look long, but I'll upload it for you if it doesn't just pop up here. Where F. Scott Fitzgerald has his character explain that, you know, in order to understand the First World War, you have to, you know, you have to understand these features of the old world. And then he runs through this list of very romantic things. You know, the king, we'll just say king, God, country, your grandfather's whiskers, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then he concludes this amazing passage by saying it was just this burst of love, right? And you go, love, I mean, just love of that old world, right? You did it because you believed in these things. Right? And then ultimately it inverted, right? And you realize the very things that you did it because you loved were your enemies, your God, your country, your king, your parents, they're the ones that were sending you out there, right? So it's just this horrible burst of love. And the other is Hemingway's quote, and I'll post these both for you, where he says things like glory, things like duty, things like gallantry and so on, those words become obscene, right, in retrospect. So this general disquiet, disillusionment is the word, right? But here Remarque, you know, talks about it in a very immediate sense when he goes back and, you know, he's just not able to feel comfortable among people who don't know what's going on out there. Page 160. A sense of strangeness will not leave me. I cannot feel at home amongst these things. There is my mother. There is my sister. There is my case of butterflies. There is the mahogany piano. But I am not myself there. There is a distance, a veil between us. And all of the, you know, conversations with her mother. Was it very bad out there, Paul? I mean, what can he say? And here's a very important theme that's going to influence both interwar periods and then really also post-Second World War issues, is the breakdown of language. How can you use language to describe these things? And the study of the memoir, like Remarque's memoir, and like Ernst Jünger, and whoever put up with who you'd like to read other First World War memoirs. Well, that's what Paul Fussell and George Mossy and Modris Eckstein have done to extract and recognize the fact that most memoirs sort of push things into these sort of patterns. I'm called the myths or themes or so on. They all contain these same patterns. It's a way of organizing things. The camaraderie. You know, the disconnect between the home front and the front, the leadership principle and so on. No matter where, French, German, English, you know, they push things into those patterns. So they're all probably based in truth in some level, right? But there seems to be a sort of systematization of their descriptions of it that resulted, right? As a way, and maybe that's also covering over, you know, points where they really can't say anything more. So they borrow those notions from it. So that question of what literature, what art, what even language as a whole can do. I go to the district commandant to report myself. Slowly I walk through the streets. Occasionally someone speaks to me. I do not delay long, for I have little inclination to talk. Right? And that there's that closing up of the front veteran as opposed to everybody else. And then he runs to, I'm just going to call him a Dietrich type. We all know what we mean by that, right? I explained to him that I arrived and leave only an hour or two since, thinking that he would then trot along, but not at all. He gets even more furious. You think you can bring your frontline manners here? What? Well, we don't stand for that sort of thing. Thank God we have discipline here, right? So one of these bastards. But, you know, even worse, he can't talk to his father. His father still believes in the cause and so on and so forth, page 165. He wants me to tell him about the front. He is curious in a way that I find stupid and distressing. A man cannot talk of such things. I would do it willingly, but it's too dangerous for me to put these things into words. I'm afraid that they might become gigantic and I may no longer be able to master them. What would become of us if everything that happens out there were quite clear to us? Right, so it speaks for itself. Or doesn't speak for itself, I should say. And then between 167 and 168 or so, he hears some people talking about the war. They're talking about the possibility for breaking through. And he says, I reply, that in our opinion, a breakthrough may not be possible. Right? So he tells the truth, and they just can't accept that. You know, that it can't be. So that there you get an idea of what continues to motivate at least the politics, driven from home, driven from the top, right up to that last offensive. They can't accept that it's not going to work. Ultimately, what happens when he's at home? He starts to wish that he were back with his comrades on page 169. When I see them here in their homes, in their offices, about their occupations, I fear an irresistible attraction in it. I would like to be here too and forget the war. But also it repels me. It is so narrow. How can that fill a man's life? You ought to smash it to bits. How can they do it? Well, out at the front, the splinters are whining over the shell holes, and star shells go up. The wounded are carried back in the waterproof sheets, and the comrades crouch in the trenches. They are different men here, men I cannot properly understand, whom I envy and despise. I must think of Kat and Albert and Müller and Jad, and what will they be doing? So that's and as I told you, Wilfred Owen, he couldn't stand it. He went back. From a cultural historical standpoint, this breakdown of language, this breakdown of civilization between, say, pages 171 and 173, he looks at his books, right? He was literate. He was gebildet in German. He was cultivated. I want that quiet rapture again. I want to feel the same powerful, nameless urge that I used to feel when I turned to my books. Right? But words, 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 they do not reach me. Slowly I place the books back in the shelves. Never more. Quietly I go out of the room. Right? So, you know, all of the romance that this is heightening and a character building process belied by remarked imagery here. Finally, before he goes back, I think almost going to visit the mother of a fallen comrade, right? And you know, she wants to hear the truth. I want to know it. I must know it. And he is saying, I will never, never tell her. She can make mincemeat out of me first. I pity her. She strikes me rather stupid all the same. Kemmerich will stay dead whether she knows about it or not. I have to tell her how it happened, so I invent a story, and I almost believe it myself. Right, so there's that surface of cleansing, right? That, you know, that we deride, that we decry, we look at it when it's done officially and in propaganda and movies and John Wayne and so on and so forth, but on the other hand, it's just a natural thing when dealing with these sort of things, including, or especially on the part of the soldiers themselves. Ultimately, you know, it's heartbreaking. He's leaving his mother, right? I bite into the pillow. I grasp the iron rods of my bed with my fists. I ought never to have come here. Out there, I was indifferent and hopeless. I will never be able to do so again. I was a soldier, and now I am nothing but an agony for myself, for my mother, for everything that is so comfortless and without end. I ought never to have come on leave. So there's that complete disconnect. It shouldn't have even come back. So to try to make some time for discussion, I'll move from there, which is 185, to 216. And here begins one of the most famous passages, another one of the most famous passages in this book. If you've ever read it, you know it well. If you watch the movie, you'll see it. But it's the situation where he jumps into a shell hole, has to do hand-to-hand combat with a Frenchman, and kills the Frenchman, and the Frenchman dies a long, agonizing death, and Paul is confronted with the reality of having killed, whereas he's been able to, you know, do it with the machine gun and from afar and so on and so forth. So here, you know, here's what happens when the drone hits, you know, what happens on the ground, and he is forced to deal with it. And, I mean, it speaks for itself, but the point is that the whole passage is Remarque's reminder that every one of those casualties that I read through, and I have the list here in case we want to go through them country by country, but up to 37 million total casualties and 8,500,000 reported dead and 7 million reported missing, right, is a person. Okay. So when you read these numbers and you hear those numbers of Verdun and the Somme and so on and so forth, what I usually do when I'm really pushing for drama is get you to imagine a football stadium full, like at Ann Arbor, a big one, or the Rose Bowl of people, so 100,000 people, right? And realize that any one battle, five of those football stadiums full of people died, or were casualties, or seven, right? Or at the whole of the sum, 1.2 million. So 12 football stadiums full of men died at that one sector, right? But each and every one of those has brothers, sister, parents, children, so on and so forth, right? And that's what Remarque is doing in this passage, by making Paul look through that wallet, see those pictures, and then feel that remorse on actually dealing with someone. Comrade, I did not want to kill you. If you jumped in here again, I would not do it. Page 223. If you would be sensible, too. But you were only an idea to me before, an abstraction that lived in my mind and called forth its appropriate response. It was that abstraction I stabbed. But now, for the first time, I see you're a man like me. And so forth, right? Band of Brothers has a moment where this very nervous soldier finally is able to fire his weapon, and he kills a German. He can see the German that he killed, and he walks up and finds the body. I don't know if you remember this, and he's got the Edelweiss, and he puts the Edelweiss on his own tunic shortly before he then dies. Right, so Band of Brothers builds in this same scene, basically, where he sees that this person was real. Right, so most anti-war movies have this moment, but here's Remarque sort of establishing it, right, in the midst of the mechanized, depersonalized war. But, and I think this is the punchline, really, in this situation. After this. And you should read it. I mean, read it. I mean, if you haven't, read it. I mean, it's powerful. Page 229. After all of this, he gets back and says, I hardly understand it myself anymore, hours later. Right? It was only because I had to lie there with him so long, I say. After all, war is war. Right? So even though he's had this epiphany, he shakes right out of it and shifts right back. Right? So I think that's Remarque's reminder that under these circumstances, moments like that are fleeting. I'm going to spare you on page 262, 263, and 264 the specific descriptions of the hospital. Okay? But here, Remarque does, and in, also early in the book with Kemmerich and his foot in his boot, right, does, you know, do what Dix, you know, tried to do in some of this imagery, right, which was to remind people of those wounds. That's wrong one. And that the fact that you do have hospitals full of that, right, and that as Friedrich, you know, did when he got these photographs out there. And I'll just say that in Madison, Wisconsin, hotbed of pinko liberalism that it is, right? I grew up in the heart of red radical Wisconsin, right? Five blocks away from a veterans hospital, okay? Just down the hill from my beautiful, nice little neighborhood. And there's a little hotel there that's still there where the families of the people who came to visit that VA hospital. And I can tell you, having grown up there and supposedly having this consciousness of what was going on around with academic parents and everything, nobody ever, ever talked about what was in that VA hospital, who was in that VA hospital, what those stories were. I never once ever heard it ever discussed. But five blocks away, those guys were in there, and their families were coming and walking over there. And now I look at it and I go, you know, here we were resisting the Vietnam War, and nobody ever talked about that. The soldiers from the Korean War and the Vietnam War were hit right there. And I'll just leave it. Despite the fact that, as he says on page 263, a hospital alone shows what war is. Right. So, Remarque on it. Okay. Now, through this, as through the Ernst Jünger versions and the movie versions and the Band of Brothers and so on and so forth, that theme of camaraderie comes through. And I don't deny that it is. I mean, you can understand that. I've had, you know, played sports to a high level and continued to play hockey until the knees just gave out last year. And, you know, so I know this macho world and the Band of Brothers who get together and play hockey at noon. I mean, we've got this sort of identity. You know, there's no question about it, and I derived a lot from it. So that's about as close as I can get to it. But trying to remind myself that, you know, to use that to try to understand what these soldiers have gone through, because I was lucky enough not to have to serve, right? So studying it that way, right? I can't deny that I would get caught up in that. Certainly not as a cot, but maybe as a Paul going, where should I go? Please tell me what to do, right? It is a great brotherhood, which adds something of the good fellowship of the folk song, of the feeling of solidarity of convicts, and the desperate loyalty to one another of men condemned to death, to a condition of life arising out of the midst of danger, out of the tension and forlornness of death, seeking in a wholly unpathetic way a fleeting enjoyment of the hours as they come. If one wants to appraise it, it is at once heroic and banal. But who wants to think about it? Right. So again, that great brotherhood. So even in this anti-war novel, he presents that. Right. But you have to remember, all of them die. Right. His whole group dies. Right. So the punchline here is that, yeah, they have that camaraderie, but there's no one left to sort of apply it in this case. As opposed to, let's say, Ernst Jünger saying, well, that's the basis for a new, you know, a new society, a new culture. So, going to the end here, page 284 and 285. Specific, sort of, from the ground information about the summer of 1918 in preparation for that last offensive. So he takes us right up to the end, into that hope you know, that there's going to be some sort of breakout, and that, that it's, there's some possibility of Germany actually succeeding. I'll just say summer of 18, the last entrance, the breath of hope that sweeps over the scorched fields, right? Why not? Why didn't make the end? Why did these rumors of the end fly about and so on? I mean, I'll just skip over that, but it just shows. He takes you through 1918 in that hope, right? So here we are in the last stages of the war, the last weeks of the war, and he's out with Kott, okay, the person that he loves and respects the most, the leader, the embodiment of the leader principle. But while bringing food, Kott falls. We two are alone. I bind up his wound. His shin seems to be smashed. It has got the bone, and Kott groans desperately. At last, just at the last, right? So these deaths in the last weeks of the war or during the last offensive, right? Particularly bad. And so Paul puts him on his back. He thinks he's just got a shin wound, a leg wound, and carries him, you know, back. And to the end, to the hospital, where a lance corporal ultimately lets him know that he has also, probably while he was carrying him, caught a splinter in the head. There's just one little hole. It must have been a very tiny stray splinter. But it has sufficed. Kott is dead. Slowly I get up. Would you like to take his paybook and his things? The lance corporal asks me. I nod, and he gives them to me. The order is mystified. You are not related, are you? Not in quotes. No, we are not related. No, we are not related. Do I walk? Have I feet still? I raise my eyes. I let them move around and turn myself with them. One circle, and I stand in the midst, and he's literally just dizzy. Spinning. All is as usual, only the malicious man Stanislaus Kaczynski has died. Then I know nothing more. So we'll just say he passes out or something like that. So just this bleak, black end to the camaraderie, right, and to the leader. So as opposed to Ernst Junger and the right-wing version, this is the message that Remarque is saying. Yeah, Kott could have survived anything, except the war. And then the final pages. One more expression on 294 of the lost generation notion. Had we returned home in 1916, out of the suffering and the strength of our experience, we might have unleashed a storm. Now, if we go back, we will be weary, broken, burnt out, rootless, and without hope. We will not be able to find our way anymore. Okay. So again, you can read that as morbid and depressing and just a complete expression of the experience of the war. But you also, for our class, have to read that as a political statement, right, in the circumstances, that war was a mistake from the beginning, a catastrophe throughout, and in the end led to nothing, especially for Germany, right? And that is a, you know, that is a counter, not just to the ennoblement of the war effort itself, but to the call that the torch be raised and continued. And when we do get to the Nazis, you're going to see they are absolutely explicit, and that the First World War and this notion of the need to pick up where they left off is probably the most, and was likely, the most influential component of their ideology. We still see the Nazis, we still see the Jews, and we still, but national pride, national regeneration, and revenge for the failure to win the First World War. That's what most people could generally agree with the far right, even if they were leftists, because of the, you know, the fundamental nationalism of it. And what I'm going to show you in The Triumph of the Will and in Hitler's language,
that this is the, this is fundamental to Nazi ideology, right? And maybe the key, really, to why they were successful, right? And why people could say, well, the Jew thing, that's one thing. Maybe that's off to the side. But the war thing, we accept, we believe that. Right? So the Dietrichs continue, right, in that regard. So that sense, I'll just read the last passage. I've set it up, I think, enough. He fell in October 1918. Okay, so like Wilfred Owen, the war's over. It was November 11th, Armistice Day, right? On a day that was so quiet and still on the whole front that the army could report it, confine itself to the single sentence, all quiet on the Western Front. He had fallen forward and lay on the earth as though sleeping. Turning him over, one saw that he could not have suffered long. His face had an expression of calm, as though almost glad the end had come. So, no glory, no great moment, not even an offensive within the context of the First World War. You know, just a sniper shot in the midst of the day, right? Totally insignificant. All quiet on the Western Front. So the life of this character just snuffed out like that, right? So none of the romantic justifications or aesthetics apply to his death. Right? And then obviously the fact that he's almost glad the end had come. He wasn't going to have to go home and try to figure out what to do when he'd come to believe that everything was lost. Right? He didn't face, you know, probably more difficult for the veterans who do go home, right, and don't die in that regard. Right? So a very bleak and pessimistic representation, which clearly contradicted at the time the hope. I'll say hope. It was insistence, right? And in retrospect, we look back at the Ernst Jungers and we say, oh, you bastard, how could you have promoted this notion that the war was worthwhile and could lead to something else? But on the other hand, again, I don't want to over... or let's say underestimate their intentions, which was to somehow validate what they had gone through in the war. I mean, we're going to look at it and say, naughty, naughty, bad, bad. That leads into Nazism and the revival of a new war. But on the other hand, you know, the Jungers are attempting to explain and put into some sort of a productive frame what they went through and happened to survive, but so many of their comrades went through and did not survive. Right? So I think you have to, in considering this or any war literature about any war films about any of our wars, right? You've got to balance the two or the many sides out, because all of them have a little bit of truth. Right. I mean, Remarque is really pushing it towards that negative side, and Jungers pushes it maybe towards the positive side. But you know, and the truth is a complicated combination of those things. For our purposes in trying to understand how the war evolved and then impacted interwar German culture, right? Just keep those two sides in mind, because much of the discourse is centered on that issue.